temporary center in Amor and then ultimately destroyed. Amor is probably a term for most of Syria. I came to Amor, and then I proceeded to receive tribute from three big Phoenician cities. They're not called Phoenician, I put that word in there. Three cities from Byblos, from Sidon, and from Arwad. Arwad is a small island just off the coast of Syria, northern Syria. Byblos and Sidon are both still very well-known sites along the coast of Lebanon and Syria. I crossed over to Arwad by ship, and along the seashore there, I killed a narwhal, or a seahorse, as a sporting activity. Afterwards, on my return march to Ashur, I passed through Great Hatti. Great Hatti is the term they will use now always for Anatolia, Great Hatti. I subjected the entire country of Great Hatti, and I received tribute from Ili-Teshub, cedar beans, and talons of broken. We don't know what. Great Hatti. All right, now from this inscription, if we didn't know anything else, we would assume first that Great Hatti was probably a very significant power at this time, and that Amor and the coast here likewise represented major Canaanite or Amorite or Phoenician types of cities. In fact, Assyria at this time is a relatively minor power, and these areas are likewise in a very much reduced state. So that when he says he marched through all of Hatti and took tribute from it, if he had said that 300 years earlier, that would have been a major claim, because that would have been at the height of the Hittite Empire. But now when he marches through Hatti, what is he marching through? He's marching through a largely declining and reduced civilization of the Neo-Hittites who followed the Hittite destruction of 1200 BC. So Tiglath claims to have come over to the Great Sea, taking timber from the Lebanon and return. No reference to the sea people. He does refer to Sidon, Arwad, and Byblos, but doesn't say who's living there, whether Canaanites, Phoenicians, or sea peoples. Now we want to turn to the really more directly relevant material, which is the biblical text. And we're going to spend the whole rest of today on the biblical thing, and we'll see if we finish that. Yeah.
You may have mentioned that in passing, but back to what you just said about Tiglath-Pileser. Mm-hmm. What's the reference to Nairi, the Nairi countries?
Yes, this is one of the reasons why the first reference to the Great Sea is in doubt. These are countries which are really up near the Caspian Sea, which are up directly north of, it's off our map here, yeah, directly north, here, this way, in this area. And these countries are not in Turkey, they're not in North Syria, so his initial move may have been north out of Syria, then across this way, and then up into Turkey proper. That's the usual reading of those countries. That's why the first reference to Great Sea is questionably the Mediterranean. But when he mentions Lebanon and Tyre and Sidon, then he obviously is along the sea coast.
But you're suggesting that we don't think automatically of the Mediterranean.
No, there are other references to this sea also, the Caspian, as a great sea. But the word for great sea is the Mediterranean. But there are Assyrian references to the Caspian. There are also references to Lake Van as a sea. When the later Assyrian annals, they march up against Urartu and the countries of the north, then they also make mention sometimes of Lake Van. Okay. We're going to start off today with Judges 1. We're going to do a bit of reading and a bit of interpolating between some of the reading to try to string together the biblical picture of Israelite history at this point, and to show how that relates to the regional countries. There is no relation beyond Jordan and Palestine into Syria and Lebanon at this point. Biblical history now is very narrow. It talks just about this small region, which is the heart of our course, namely Jordan and Palestine. We have no reference to any contact with the Assyrians or the Hittites, and in fact, it's very interesting that there is no reference in any of this material to the Egyptians. It's a striking fact that the texts that we're about to be describing do not mention the Egyptians at all. And that is something a little bit that I still can't quite understand. You would expect there to be at least some tangential references to the Egyptians during this period, even though the Egyptians were in a state of decline. Instead, the Egyptians go without mention, and the only discussion relates the Israelites to, as we will see, the Canaanites and Amorites, the Sea Peoples, the Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites, and then we also have some substantial contact with the farthest, most southern areas, Arabia, the so-called Midianites, as we're going to read a little bit here. We have some contact here with Midian also, which is the northern Hejaz area. The picture we had from the Egyptian texts was that Israel was somehow present in this area around 1200 as a people. Then around 1175, Ramses III is attacked by the Sea Peoples. He throws them back, but we would argue it's probably pretty much of a stalemate, where the Sea Peoples then end up along the coast, and the Egyptians are content to stay down in Egypt. It is really because of the fact that Egypt is not mentioned in the biblical sources at all that I would tend to put most of these texts after 1175. Because up until the battle with the Sea Peoples, Egypt was still a strong force here. The fact that only the Sea Peoples are talked about and not Egypt would suggest that the Israelites here are talking about a period when Egypt had just pulled out of the field entirely. And the archaeological evidence would tend to agree with that. We have a minimal amount of Egyptian material. Then, when Amon also shows this area to be in control of the Cheker, or one type of Sea People, although we have Canaanite names, such as Zacharbaal, the king of Byblos. These Egyptian texts mention the Israelites to begin with, but they're only the Sea Peoples. The Sea Peoples are obviously the dominant and key power. Now let's go back and pick up where we left off with the biblical tradition on the conquest. You'll remember that we brought the Israelites across Sinai by one of perhaps two routes through eastern Jordan, bypassing Edom and Moab with a battle at Heshbon here and another one up near the Yarmouk here to take the Amorite territories of Sihon and Og. Then, proceeding across to the west bank, were the two-pronged attacks, one to the south and one to the north, which, according to the book of Joshua, brought all of the hill country and much of the plains into the control of the invading Israel. Then, as we left that text, we indicated that there were, however, certain biblical texts which left in doubt the speed of the conquest and also the completeness with which it was carried out. And we want to concentrate on that aspect now, namely the post-conquest and or alternate type of conquest. We're going to talk now about the Israelite settlement in the land, which may be also talking about the conquest. We don't know. It may be the very same thing. But it's a definitely different type of account from this Joshua barging in, destroying everything kind of story. This is found largely in the first two books, the first two chapters and following of Judges. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel asked the Lord, "Who of us should go up first against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And that, to start off with, isn't that a rather strange statement? This is after the death of Joshua. The people are all together at, this is presumably in the central hill country. It says, now, who of us should go up and fight against the Canaanites? Well, in the preceding story, it sounded as if they'd all been wiped out and there weren't any Canaanites to be attacked. Then it goes on. Judah shall go up first. The tribe of Judah is that which eventually settled here from Jerusalem and to the south. Judah should go up first. Behold, I've given the land into his hand. And Judah said to Simeon, his brother. Simeon is the tribe which ultimately settled also right next to Judah down here. Simeon, come on up with me into the territory which has been allotted to me, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I will go with you when you have to fight for your territory. So let's go together. So Simeon went up with him, and Judah went up, and Yahweh was with them, and gave the Canaanites into their hand. And they defeated thousands of them at Bezek, and Adonai Bezek fought against them, but he was defeated, and the Canaanites were also defeated. They pursued them, cut off his thumbs and his great toes, and they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. And the men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it and smote it with the edge of the sword. We're going to see just a few paragraphs later here, there's an outright contradiction to that statement. And then later we're going to see that David, King David, is supposed to be the first to have ever taken Jerusalem. The men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it and smote it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. And afterward, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites, who dwelt where? In the Shephelah, and in the Negev, and in the hill country. And Judah went against the Canaanites, who dwelt in Hebron, and they defeated the kings there. And from there they went against many cities. I won't go into detail here. Many cities in the southern area of Palestine. So Judah went with Simeon, and they defeated the Canaanites. And they also took, now a very interesting statement. It says, Judah took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron are three cities which are right smack on the seacoast. Remember in the statement of Joshua, it said they took the hill country, but it never made the claim that they went all the way to the seacoast. This is very interesting that it claims that they took the whole seacoast. I'm going to come back to that again later. This is Judges 1, verse 18. All right. Now the next statement. Then it says, they could not drive out all the inhabitants of the plain. The plain would be here. Because they had chariots of iron. In other words, they took some major cities, but they could not take, they could not completely drive out the inhabitants. Then, the tribe of Benjamin was not able to drive out the Jebusites, who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites lived in the middle of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. So, on the one hand, Judah said that it took Jerusalem. On the other hand, Benjamin said it could not. And we're going to see later that the Jebusites continued to live there until the time of David. So, it's a problem. We can't solve all these details. But what I want those problems to be clear. The house, or unclear, as the case may be. The house of Joseph went up against Bethel. This is Ephraim, now moving to the north. Joseph went up against Bethel, and they went in and they took the city and they changed its name to Luz. And Manasseh tried to drive out, but could not take Beth Shan and Taanach, or Dor, and Ibleam and Megiddo. Taanach, Beth Shan, Taanach, and Megiddo are all right in the plain of Esther Elam. Manasseh was right here. Here it makes the statement, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of these cities, but the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. And when Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out. Ephraim did not drive out Gezer, but they made the Canaanites dwell among them. And we go on. Asher, who lived along the coast, this is an important one. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko, which is modern-day Acre, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or Aphek. These are all right along the coast. But the Asherites dwelt with the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they could not drive them out. Lastly, in this account, we want to emphasize the tribe of Dan. Dan was a tribe that originally claimed this territory right down here. Dan. The Amorites pressed the Danites back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. The Amorites persisted in dwelling along the plain, but the house of Joseph, Ephraim, became heavy on them and made them become slaves. That is the general description of the settlement on the west side. It's a very different picture from Joshua's account of the total campaign taking the entire country. It has internal contradictions of its own, but it seems to be clear that the conquest here and the settlement was a gradual process requiring the amalgamation of a number of cities and peoples in different areas. Notice, however, that this account makes the claim that part of the seacoast belongs to the Israelites, and there is no mention in any of this of the Philistines. We have no claim or no reference to the fact that there are sea peoples or Philistines anywhere along that seacoast. When we come over to East Jordan, we have very few problems. According to the biblical tradition, there were two and a half tribes which settled in East Jordan. Those are Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. Reuben took the territory from the Wadi Mojib to the north. And Gad took the area roughly from Amman up to the Yarmouk River, and half the tribe of Manasseh took from the Yarmouk River up to Mount Hermon. This is the allotted area for Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. Yes.
Can you repeat that?
Yes. Two and a half tribes, according to the biblical tradition, stayed on the east bank of Jordan. Reuben was put in the south between the Wadi Mojib and roughly Amman area. And then from Amman to the Yarmouk was given to Gad, and then from the Yarmouk north to Manasseh, the half of Manasseh. Half of Manasseh was east, and half of Manasseh was west. These are the two and a half tribes. Those divisions are fuzzy, however. I just said that it was Reuben that was down here at the Wadi Mojib, right? When I read to you one of the biblical accounts of the Exodus, and the alternate story I gave you said that the Israelites came up through Dibon. What was the word that was used for Dibon? What? It didn't say Dibon Reuben. Dibon is right here. According to what I just told you, Dibon should be settled by Reuben. Alright, it said Dibon Gad. G-A-D. So that I'm simplifying it when I say these are the general borders. The two and a half tribes were over here, and usually it's divided the way I said. But there are some hints in place names and things that it wasn't all that firm. It wasn't all that subtle. The tribes were probably fluid. Yeah.
How far north did half of Manasseh go from the...
It's a little bit vague, but in its greatest extent, half of Manasseh went up to Hermon. Where's my... Yarmouk up to Hermon, yeah, roughly to here. Hermon in southern Syria. That tradition is rather clear, and we're going to see that being reinforced again and again when we have some conflicts now with the neighboring peoples, especially on the part of these east bank areas. All right, now let's go and see what the Israelites living in those areas. These are 11 tribes. The 12th tribe was the tribe of Levi, which was not given any territory. The 11 tribes each were allotted a certain area. The 12th tribe was cultic and religious only, and it did not have any terrain assigned to it as a territory. Now, this group of 12 tribes is, as you can imagine, and as it's already somewhat been described, a rather loose confederation of mixed peoples, to be honest. We can't, the biblical tradition does not say that they are mixed peoples, but it's very clear that they are a loosely held together confederation, which not only fought with the external world, but fought within each other as well. They fought between each other. But when they were fighting between each other, this was between the family. When they had to defend themselves against an external enemy, this is where the 12 tribes united, often to defend the entire confederation. This is sometimes called the 12 tribe league, which is also sometimes called who knows how to spell it?
M-I-O-N.
And Picatinone. Doesn't look right. It's Amphictyony. I think there's another Y in there. Like that. Amphictyony. Well, don't worry. It's a Greek word for a tribe, a group of tribes that unite around the sanctuary in a very loose kind of confederation without a central monarch or a monarchy and with no capital. And this suits Israel's situation exactly. At this time, they have no capital city. We're going to see that the central power moves from small city to small city to small city, and no one city had any major political power. No individual had political power either. No one was called a melech, a king. Everyone was instead, as we call it from the book, judges. This is not a judge in the legal sense. It is a leader who defends the country and rallies the people, particularly in time of war. And we want to see now some of these typical judges and how they operate. The first one we give you is Ehud and Eglon, king of Moab. Each time we do one of these now, we want to be watching two things. We want to not only be seeing what the biblical perspective is on this story, but we want to always be seeing also what we might be learning about that neighboring country that is involved. This neighboring country happens this time to be Moab. And the king of Moab here is the second king that we know of. There is an earlier one, Balak, who we didn't mention at the beginning of the course, but later I'll be giving you a complete list of the Moabite, Ammonite, and Edomite kings as known. The first king of Moab was Balak, and he tried to curse the Israelites when they first arrived. The second king is Eglon. Eglon, king of Moab, we aren't going to hear too much about him, but it's a very fascinating story anyway. This is a typical story of the judges. Theological book. There's always got to be a reason for trouble. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and therefore the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. All right, that's the same kind of thing we'll see later. The Moabites say about their failures whenever they are doing something evil inside of their God, then he also sells them down the river. So this is a typical explanation for your nation's woes. We have it still today. I am just thinking of our nameless close friend here, who is a rather conservative individual, who very clearly relates such things as rainfall, political events, pure and simple, to the nation's religious purity. And that's still a tendency which is very strong in certain parts of the Near East. So this is a strong biblical but also nearby tradition. Eglon, king of Moab, and what did he do? Eglon gathered to himself, and this is the first time we're going to have reference to them, the Ammonites. Eglon in Moab, presumably somewhere here, we're not given any cities, but he's coming from somewhere in Moab, gathers together Ammonites. Ammonites being from around Ammon and to the east. Again, we're not given any specific details as to where they were. And he brought also together Amalekites. Now, the Amalekites are far more difficult to deal with. We don't really know where they came from. They were a nomadic group, apparently, that moved not only through northern Arabia, but the southern part of the Negev Desert, etc. He went, Eglon, and defeated Israel. And they took possession of the city of palms, which is Jericho. All right, so Jericho, presumably, was in control prior to this of the Israelites. And the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, for 18 years. Now, that's a rather striking statement. 18 years is not a short period of time. 18 years, it says, Moab was dominant over the Israelites. Now, the years are... we cannot take them entirely literally, because if we would add up all the years that are given in the book of Judges, we get far too many years for the period of time, which is 200 years, that we're talking about. And yet, there may be some relevance to the number of years that are given here as approximately the time of year, the time span that was involved. Many have argued that these things did not happen in a sequence, but rather overlap. That is, some of these things were going on at the same time in a rather embroiled, decentralized, Confederate type of situation when central power was lacking. All right, he gathered Ammonites and Amalekites, and he made Israel serve Moab. But when we want to watch this, because we're going to see that in the archaeology, Moab and the Iron One period has got some fantastic wall installations in Iron One, while in Israel at this time there are very few. This could well be correct, that the Moabites were dominant for a period of time. And when the people of Israel cried to the Lord did what? He raised up a judge, Ehud from Benjamin. Benjamin was north of Jerusalem in the hill country. Invariably, most of these judges come from the hill country, which was the central point of Israelite religion. And Ehud, the Benjaminite, was a, anybody know this story? Left-handed man. He was a left-handed man. This is a great story. Remember this from my childhood. The people of Israel sent tribute every year through Ehud to Eglon, the king of Moab. And Ehud, being a crafty man, made for himself a sword with two edges. And he made it rather short so that he could hide it in his right thigh under his dress. Then he went and presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very, very fat man. And when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute to him, he asked for all the people who carried the tribute to go away. But he himself turned back and said, "O king, I have a secret message for you which I have to deliver in private." And the king said, "Silence." And all of the attendants of the king left. And Ehud came up to him as he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, "I have a message from God for you." And the king rose up in his seat. And Ehud reached with his left hand, I never quite figured this out, let's see, with his left hand and took the sword from his right thigh and thrust it into the belly of Eglon, and then he pushed it in so that the hilt went in after the blade and the fat closed over the blade so that he could not draw out the sword. And all of his guts came out.
Yes.
Then Ehud went out into the vestibule, and he closed the doors of the roof chamber upon him, and he locked them. And when he had gone away, the servants of the king came, and when they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, "Ah, the king is relieving himself in the heat of the day. We should not disturb him." And so they waited until they were at a complete loss, and then they finally opened, but they still didn't open the door until they finally did open it, and they found their lord dead on the floor. And Ehud escaped while they were delaying. He passed back over into Israel, and when he arrived, he trumpeted in the hill country of Israel, and they went down with him at their head. And he said, "Follow me, because the Moabites are going to be given into your hand." And they crossed over the Jordan River at the fords, probably somewhere in the Shunah area, and they killed at that time about 10,000 Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men. Not one of them escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. All right, that now is the first conflict of a military type or semi-military type between the Israelites and the Moabites. And we can't, it has elements of popular, you know, popularization to it, but it typifies the kinds of relationships that Israel had with these neighboring countries, especially Moab. Now, Moab acted at this time with the support of the Ammonites, but still no reference yet to the Philistines. Let's go on now to the next example of Israelite judges, which is Deborah. These are rather brutal and gory stories, so yeah.
Was Kerak one of the Moabite capitals?
Yeah, Kerak, located here, was probably the capital, was the capital of Moab at certain times. It was called Kir Hareshet. And that became probably Kerak, probably, by shortening it, Kir. It became Kir Hul, which then became Kerak. There are some problems, but it's probably the same. Right. Unfortunately, it doesn't say in here that Eglon came from Kerak.
We wish it would.
Would help. We don't know where he came from. He could have come from any other city as well. All right, the next one is a Canaanite-Israelite conflict, not Israelite, Moabite, and Ammonite. This is Deborah fighting Jabin, the king of Hazor. Now, automatically, when I say Hazor, you should have a problem, because according to the book of Joshua, Hazor, or Hazor, was destroyed and burned to the ground under Joshua, and shouldn't exist anymore. So many people have argued that this account that we're about to read from you is displaced one way or the other. That is, it belonged either in this Judges period, as it is, or it was displaced here from the conquest, one way or the other. You could look at it either direction. All right, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud. Mount Tabor with 10,000 men, and they routed him and all his chariots and all of his army at the edge of the sword. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled from the battle on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots, and all of the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. There wasn't one man left. The best part is really to come. Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. The Kenites were in league with the Israelites, and Yael was a secret friend of the Israelites. And Sisera flees away and goes into her tent to escape from the army, and she says, come on into my tent, there won't be any trouble. I'll give you a little milk, and you can go inside and sleep. And so while he licks his wounds and has his milk and lies down, she then goes out, takes one of the stakes from the tent, and pounds it through his temple and drives it into the ground. So he is killed by nothing worse than a woman. And this is then the subject of a song, the defeat of Sisera and his death by Jael. The interesting thing is this song now in Judges 5 is one of our oldest Hebrew songs. The written text, which I'm reading to you here, is probably recorded quite late. We can't say when, but it's written prose. Songs that you see here, which are poetic and which were orally sung, these are probably the oldest parts of the Old Testament, and they contain the best evidence for historical data. This song, called the Song of Deborah, gives us a lot of information about the Israelites, and I'll just read a couple passages here. It celebrates the defeat of Sisera, but it tells us even more about the Israelites, and this is what I want you to see. Among the clans of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. Why did you tarry among the sheepfolds to hear the piping for the flocks? Among the clans of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. Reuben is over here, and it says, why did you wait by the sheepfold while everybody else was fighting? In other words, Reuben, the tribe of Reuben, did not participate in this battle. Then, Gilead. Gilead is a general term for this whole region, including Gad and Reuben and half Manasseh. Gilead stayed over by the Jordan. But now the next sentences are even more striking. And Dan. Where did Dan live? The tribe of Dan. Here. This is the claimed territory for Dan. All right, now what does it say? It's in Dan. Why did he stay with the ships? Why did he stay with the ships? And Asher, whose territory is right here, sat still at the coast of the sea, settling down comfortably by the landings. In other words, the East Jordan tribes, Dan and Asher, did not participate in this battle, but it's more important because it shows us where they are. Where are these tribes? Dan is supposed to be down by the ships. Later on, we're going to see today that the Danites aren't here very long. They are pushed out of here, and they end up here, where all of your biblical atlases show them. But there is evidence. Yeah.
Gilead, the three east bank Israelite tribes?
Right. Gilead is really geographical. Gilead is the territory between roughly Ammon and the Yarmouk River. Ammon and the Yarmouk River, the Ajalon Mountains, is upper Gilead. North of that is Bashan. These are the biblical words geographically, no? North of that is Bashan, which is from the Yarmouk River north. That's the Golan Heights area of Syria. Okay, I want to see if you got this point, though. Dan, why did he stay by the ships, and Asher was standing by the landing? This implies, in this very early poetry, that these tribes were actually there. They were along the seacoast. And there is no reference to the sea peoples on this seacoast. No, it's Dan and Asher who are at the seacoast. And they didn't participate in the battle, but that's less relevant. All right, the kings, they came, they fought the kings of Canaan at Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. This is where the battle took place. They met at Mount Tabor, and they went over to Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. When we come to the archaeology, we're going to spend probably at least 15, 20 minutes just on the problem of Taanach and Megiddo. Taanach, by the water of Megiddo, has direct archaeological evidence relating to this whole problem, the whole problem of the Canaanite, Israelite, Sea People conflict. So this battle between the two took place there. When you say Taanach by the waters of Megiddo, what does that imply regarding the two cities, Taanach and Megiddo? Maybe too subtle. Which is the more prominent city? The more prominent city would be the first one. The first one listed, Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. Megiddo is the bigger tell. If you go to the two sites, Megiddo is a much bigger site than Taanach. But they are only about 5 miles apart. The battle would have taken place there if you wanted to say it took place in that region. You would have said at Megiddo, not at Taanach. So this implies that in this period, Taanach was more important than Megiddo, although the tell of Megiddo is much bigger for most of the periods. That's going to be important, because in the Iron Age, when we come to the archaeology, we're going to see that Taanach in Iron 1A is a very large city, while Megiddo is a shriveling little village. So that's some support for that. Most blessed of women is Jael, the wife, the tent dweller. He asked for water, she gave him milk. She brought him curds in a lordly bowl. She put her hand to the tent peg, her right hand in the mallet, and she struck Sisera a blow. She crushed his head, she shattered and pierced his temple. He sank, he fell, he lay still at her feet, he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell dead. Out of the window, this is very beautiful poetry. Now you have, out of the window she peered. Who peered? The mother of Sisera, the man who's dead. She gazes through the lattice. This is back at Hazor. Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the hoofbeats of his chariot? He's not going to come back. She's very worried about him, so he's dead. All right, that's the battle now between Israel and the Canaanites of Hazor, either taking place at the conquest or, more likely, in the period of the judges proper between the Israelites and a major Canaanite city. Let's continue. Gideon. We want to move on to Gideon, the Midianites, and the Amalekites. This one is important for a number of bits of information that we get out of it for the period of the Judges. This is Judges chapter 6. The Lord gave Israel into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Midian, we said, is northern Saudi Arabia. All right, and Midian prevailed over Israel because of Midian, the people of Israel had to make for themselves dens in the mountains and caves for strongholds. They had to pull out of the villages and move up into the hills. They had to go into caves to escape Midian. For whenever the Israelites tried to plant seed, the Midianites and the people would come up and attack them, and they would take away and destroy all their produce. Very interesting now is the geographical reference. They would, for whenever the Israelites put in seed, the Midianites would come up and attack them, and they would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the land as far as the neighborhood of Gaza. It's the strangest thing to have them say, Gaza. Everywhere else we run into Gaza, we're going to see Gaza is a sea people city. It's not an Israelite city. Again, I'm arguing that there is in this biblical tradition, there is a tradition that the Israelites did have the seacoast. before the, I'm giving myself away here, but that they have the sea coast before the sea peoples ever came. All right, there's no reference here to the sea peoples. This implies that Gaza was Israelite terrain, and that the Midianites were coming up against Gaza as a city within Israel. And they left no sustenance in Israel, no sheep or ox or ass, for they would come with their cattle and their tents like locusts for number. Both they and their camels could not be counted. This is very important. This is the first time that we have a reference to the use of camels in a military way. Camels coming up out of Arabia. This is our first evidence of camel. There are, of course, camels mentioned in the Old Testament long before this. But archaeologically, those have all been dismissed as later interpolations back. Because archaeologically, the camel, and anthropologically, the camel just is not used as a beast of burden and as an animal domesticated by man until Iron One. This is one of the major changes that comes with Iron One. The late Bronze Age, you find very few camels. Not only does Iron One bring iron, but it also brings that great beast that we all still see. Yes?
Did you mean the earliest biblical reference to camel, or the earliest reference to it?
No, this is the earliest This is the earliest reference to the camel being used in... let me see. I'm not sure if I understand. This is the earliest reference to the camel being used as in a military way. There are camels, individual camels, even buried with people, like in Upper Egypt and things, apparently as pets or donkeys also, and other sorts of things.
So my question, the earliest biblical reference or the earliest literary reference period?
No, this is the earliest biblical reference to it. Camel from this point becomes quite common, but in the previous period, if you go back through Akkadian literature and through Egyptian literature, what is the only beast on which man travels before this time?
The
donkey. Right, the ass. And there's still yet no horse. We don't yet have a horse here. I'm sorry, take that back. The horse came in the Middle Bronze Age. We have it for the chariots. It goes that way. The donkey, horse, and the camel is the latest of all of them. So the horse came down to Indo-Europeans, probably in the Middle Bronze Age, and that made possible the chariot. So camels, they could not be counted, and Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the people of Israel cried for help. Now I'm not going to go into all the these are the most important details, the use of the camel, Midian, and Gaza being here. We have Gideon doing the same kind of thing. They gather eventually for a battle up in the plain of Esdraelon. Here, Gideon takes out all of his men. He gathers hundreds of thousands of troops, and God says to him, "You'll never win with all those people. Get it down to a smaller group." This is typical holy war. You cannot win because of your own numbers. You have to win because God is on your side. And so he finally attacks with only 100 men. You probably know the story. They attack at night, and they break their jars with fire inside, and it so upsets the Midianites who are camped in the plain that they start fighting each other and they kill each other, so that it's a great victory for Israel. Okay, that is Gideon. All right, now I gave 5 minutes. Minute and a half for coffee if anybody wants to grab a certain cup of coffee. We got to keep moving. We've got the Ammonites coming up. That is a magnificent one. Looks to me like a chisel or an axe. Is this either from Abu Suman and Jerash or from Gasul or where? It's Gasul, yeah. Okay. What it looks like. It's how like a chisel. Well, it's called a chisel, but we can't determine for sure. Probably for working in wood, like this. Yeah, it's good. No. This is exactly the way chisel was. And that is where it started off originally, and this was the working edge. A lot of times you find this working edge polished. Very nice meat from these. This one is not, this may have not been used very
well.
Just a nice thing to do on these.
Yeah. 30 seconds.
In this book, this is a paraphrase.
Right.
There is an interesting reference to where.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
All the she does.
The Emma, she does ride.
No, it's called Ruddy
Ruddy's Step.
Nobody knows where that is.
Another thing that had three holes. They sold one.
Okay, Jephthah and the Ammonites, Judges 10.
First, the moment of aggression, that's the spelling of antiquity, if you want to call
it. You changed it?
This one is changed.
Since we're perfectionists,
no, we're not.
Okay, now under Jephthah, we have the first reference to outright expansion by the Ammonites. We said that under Ehud, we had Eglon, king of Moab, uniting with the Ammonites. But the Ammonites there play a very peripheral role, and we can't even trust that very much. Jephthah does battle with the Ammonites, however, in a major claim to expansion that they make.
Where are we in the Bible?
Judges chapter 10, what you mean?
Verse 6.
Yes.
Judges 10, verse 6. Okay, now we're going to continue. Now, here is also where we have very interesting first reference, first probably definite reference to the Philistines. The anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, so he sold them into the hand of the Philistines and into the hand of the Ammonites. And they crushed and oppressed the children of Israel that year. For 18 years they oppressed all the people of Israel that were beyond the Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is in Gilead. And the Ammonites crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah and against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was sorely distressed. Right, the Ammonites are here. The tribes of the Israelites that are on the other side of the Jordan, Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh, are in Gilead. The Philistines, we have referred to here now, along with the Ammonites, are oppressing the occupants east of the Jordan. And not only that, they are invading and plundering territory west of the Jordan. It's a very strange statement to say the Ammonites and the Philistines are teamed up against the Israelites. And can you, this is our first reference to the Philistines. Can you imagine why that might be? Well, we're going to see later why that might be. We're going to see that we're going to argue that the Philistines, after arriving, spread along the coast into the north half of the Jordan Valley, so that they, in a kind of a hook shape, pincher movement, isolate and try to divide the various small states, especially Israel, in this area. In that kind of movement, it would be a very natural alliance for the Philistines to work with the Ammonites at the expense of the Israelites in the hill country here. They would have the Israelites in the valley, the Philistines in the valley, pinching this way, and the Ammonites pinching from the desert side, pinching off Gilead, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh up in the mountains. And then ultimately being so successful that they raided somewhat at will in the hill country. All right, that's the picture that we get. The Ammonites were called up to arms during this time, and they encamped in Gilead. All right? In Gilead. And the people of Israel came together, and they encamped at Mizpah. Mizpah is over here, in the middle of the hill country of Palestine. And the people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, "Who is a man big enough to fight against the Ammonites? Let him be the head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." They have to have some Israelite leader who can defend Gilead against this Ammonite attack. Now, who do they pick? Now, there's a little digression here. Now, Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty warrior, but he was the son of a harlot. Gilead was the father of Jephthah, and Gilead's wife bore him sons, etc., etc., but you have to go away because you are not the son of your mother. Now, you are the son of your mother, but your mother is not the wife of your father. And worthless fellows, so Jephthah left all of his brothers, and he went to the land of Tob, T-O-B, which is somewhere up here in the northern areas of southern Syria. And this is the typical thing we see happen again and again. Worthless fellows collect around Jephthah, and they went raiding with him. This is the same thing David does later. When David is expelled, he collects all the riffraff discontents and makes up a small army out of him. So Jephthah has this raiding army. After a time, the Ammonites were making war against Israel, and the Ammonites, and when this happened, the elders of Gilead went to bring Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah, "Come and be our leader so that we can fight against this Ammonite expansion." But Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "Didn't you all hate me and drive me out of my father's house? Why do you come up here now when you're in trouble yourselves?" And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "That's why we've turned to you now, that you may go with us and fight with the Ammonites and be the head over all of the inhabitants of Gilead." And Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you bring me home again to fight with the Ammonites, and the Lord gives them over to me, then I will be the head over all Gilead." And the elders said, "Jephthah, we make a witness that this will be the case." So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him the head and the leader over them, and he spoke all of these words at Mizpah. Then Jephthah sent messengers, and this is a very, very interesting historical document now. Great dispute here. Jephthah sends messengers over to the Ammonites. Unfortunately, it doesn't give us as much information as we would want. To the king of the Ammonites, and he said, "What have you got against me?" Namely, Jephthah representing the Israelites. What do you, the king of the Ammonites, have against me that you have come into our land to fight against our land?" And the king of the Ammonites answered Jephthah's messengers, and he said, "Because Israel... when Israel came from Egypt, took away my land, Ammonite land, from the Arnon to the Jabbok to the Jordan, from the Mojib to the Zirka to the Jordan River." In other words, the Ammonites are now claiming exactly the same territory that the Israelite tribes had claimed. And it said the Israelites took this from the Ammonites. Now, according to the biblical tradition, who did they take it from?
The Amorites.
The Amorites, that's correct. Sihon and Og. All right, now this is what comes through in this statement. Jephthah sent messengers back to the king of the Ammonites, and he said, "Israel didn't take away any land of Moab or of Ammon. But when they came up from Egypt, they went through the wilderness, and then they sent messengers to Edom, let us pass, but they wouldn't let us pass, so we went around, and we also passed to Moab. And then we sent messengers to the king of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, at Heshbon. He would not trust us, so we encamped and fought with Israel. And the Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated him. And they took possession of all the territory of the Amorites, from the Arnon to the Jabbok, and from the wilderness to the Jordan." In other words, what is disputed here is from the Zirka, from the Mojib, to the Zirka, from the wilderness over to the Jordan River. The Ammonites are claiming it, and the Israelites are saying, "No, we didn't take it from you, we took it from the Amorites." "So then the Lord, the God of Israel, dispossessed the Amorites before the people, and are you now going to take possession of the land which we took?" Very interesting thing follows here. "Will you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? and all that the Lord Yahweh, our God, has dispossessed before us, let us have it. It's for us. In other words, your God, let your God give you your land, and let our God give us our land. Why are you making trouble? Are you any better than Balak, king of Moab, who tried to curse Israel when they arrived, etc., etc.? While Israel was living in Heshbon, Heshbon is here, while Israel was dwelling in Heshbon and in Aroer, which is Araer, right on the banks of the Mojib, these 300 years, that's the problem now, to make this 300 years, while Israel was dwelling in these cities for 300 years, why didn't you recover these cities during that time? Why do you make a claim now, 300 years later? That I therefore have not sinned against you, and you are doing wrong by making war against us, and therefore our God shall judge today between Israel and Moab. But the king of Ammonites would not listen to the messengers that Jephthah sent him. So Jephthah crossed over to the Ammonites to fight against them, and he smote them from Aroer, which is here on the Mojib, modern-day Araer, to the neighborhood of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abu Karamim. I don't know where Minnith and Abu Karamim are, but they are in the northern part of Jordan. So, with a very great slaughter. So the Ammonites were subdued before the people of Israel that day. It's just interesting here that when Jephthah comes back, he ultimately has to kill his daughter because of a vow he made. She comes out to greet him on his return. He had vowed whoever did come back to greet him, he would give up his own daughter. So he had to give up his own daughter. Alright, that's the first evidence of Ammonite expansion under Jephthah. It's going to come again later under Saul. And this pressure, there is obviously two different groups of people claiming the same terrain in East Jordan. Let's move on now to, well, I'm going to just tell you what happens in these incidents at Shechem, Dan, and Gibeah. I'll read the one at Gibeah because that's a very good account. These are important from the internal point of view. These incidents are not conflicts between Israelites and neighboring countries. They are conflicts between different Israelite groups. The incident at Shechem is in the heart of the Israelite terrain, and Shechem, there is a war there between different factions supporting different rulers. And it ends up with an awful lot of bloodshed, and certain cities are destroyed, and then one of the rulers is killed by a woman dropping a millstone off the top of one of the great fortified pillars there. So Shechem sees civil war between the Israelites. The incident at Dan. Dan, it says in this account, that Dan was living here, but Dan was pushed back by the Amorites. It says Amorites. That's a very interesting statement. It does not say sea peoples. It says Amorites. Dan was pressed back and could not inhabit this area. Therefore, Dan sent people up here to the north part of the country to try to find another suitable place to live. And when they passed through this terrain, they came across a man who had a high priest with all kinds of idols, and they ultimately went back and just sort of robbed that little priest with all his idols and took him with them up to Dan. And then they attacked the city of Dan, which it said was a nice, peaceful little city. It wasn't within saving distance of any major city along the Phoenician coast. They destroyed Dan, took the new priest, and set him up there. And this account and the preceding one are both prefaced with the statement, in those days there was no king in Israel. That is, there was no law and order. People did everything as they wanted and as seemed right in their own eyes. The third one is at Gibeah, and this one is in Judges 19, and it's a rather famous story. And we want to read part of it because it's not only a good story, but it also shows us something about the occupation of the land. In those days, there was no king in Israel. A certain Levite. Levite was of the tribe which was the religious tribe, not having any terrain to itself. So it would be a particular crime to violate a Levite. Levite was sojourn in the remote parts of the hill country, and he took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. So Levi was down here in Bethlehem, Shukri's country, and took a woman from this terrain, and he wanted to return now to Ephraim, which was in the north. All right, and his concubine became angry with him, and she went away from him to her... I'm sorry, he took her back up to Ephraim. Then there was a fight. He and his concubine had a fight, and she became angry, and she left him and went and returned to Bethlehem and was there for some 4 months. She went back to dad, the concubine. So the Levite arose and went after her, went to Bethlehem to speak kindly to her and to bring her back. And he had with him his servant and a couple of asses. And he came to her father's house, and the girl's father saw him. He was very happy, and they remained for 3 days. They ate and drank lobster. On the fourth day, they arose early in the morning to go back. And so they prepared to go. Then, as they were traveling from Bethlehem north, the day began to get short. And he did not want to spend the night in Bethlehem, and so he rose up and departed. And as the day was getting short, he passed by Jerusalem, Jebus. And he had with him his asses and his concubine, and when they were near Jebus, the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come on now, let's go into this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." This is an obvious problem again, because earlier it said that the city had been conquered or not conquered, depending on what you read. And the master said to him, "No, we're Israelites. We will not turn aside into a city of foreigners." In other words, this is Israelite terrain, but Jebus, Jerusalem, was a pocket of non-Israelite occupation. So